Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lee Ferris of the group United for a Fair Economy, who discusses the Senate defeat of the so-called Buffett Rule and other reforms her group advocates to make the nation's tax system fairer for working families. Everett Thompson of Amnesty International USA and former inmate Robert King, who talk about the case of the Angola 3 Louisiana prisoners, who together have spent more than 100 years in solitary confinement. And Alex Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about issues raised at the Summit of the Americas meeting with North and Latin American heads of state in Cartagena, Colombia. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During the year-long Arab Spring, the Persian Gulf state of Qatar, with major natural gas reserves, used its wealth to give an extra push to selective regime change in the Middle East and Northern Africa. In the year it led the Arab League, Qatar sent small arms to Libyan rebels, supported the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and was the first Arab country to close its embassy in Syria in protest of the brutal crackdown by President Bashar al-Assad's regime. In recent years, Qatar has also backed peace initiatives in Darfur, Lebanon, and in the Palestinian territories. Secular progressive activists in Tunisia, the birthplace of the Arab Spring, have been reluctant to embrace Qatar after the oil-rich kingdom funded Islamic parties in local elections. Many pro-democracy activists also criticized Qatar's popular satellite TV channel, Al Jazeera, for ignoring the uprising in Bahrain, which has been actively opposed by Saudi Arabia. Hussein Ibish of the American Task Force on Palestine noted Qatar and Saudi Arabia have common interests, including preserving the stability of Gulf monarchies and containing Iran and its Shia allies. In cities across the United States, Occupy Wall Street activists are joining local groups to fight home foreclosures and shine a light on abuses by Bank of America, which received $230 billion in a taxpayer-funded bailout. According to Alternet, Occupy activists have joined the call to break up Bank of America. The bank faces a wave of financial challenges, including a downgrade of its credit rating and $8.5 billion paid in a settlement for toxic mortgages held by the bank's countrywide financial unit. This comes on top of Bank of America's 2011 $335 million settlement with the U.S. Justice Department for pushing creditworthy Black and Latino borrowers into high-priced subprime loans. In January, Public Citizen filed a petition calling for Bank of America to be broken up by regulators under the authority of the Dodd-Frank Reform Act. On April 13th, Occupy activists revived its Move Your Money campaign, asking consumers to close their Bank of America accounts and move their funds to a community bank or credit union. New York-based Organizing for Occupation has engaged in direct action against home foreclosures, especially those involving Bank of America and Countrywide Financial. On May 9th, Occupy activists will join environmentalists and consumer activists at Bank of America's annual shareholders meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina, to keep the spotlight on Bank of America's long list of documented abuses. In another blow to tough guy Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, a powerful figure in conservative and Republican Party politics, Arpaio ally and former county attorney Andrew Thomas and his key aides were disbarred at a state disciplinary panel for using abusive tactics and possibly committing perjury, a felony in Arizona. Thomas was county attorney until 2010, when he ran and lost in a primary for state attorney general. This is one of the few cases successfully brought against an elected prosecutor. Thomas and former deputy county attorney Lisa Obishan are likely to appeal the disbarment ruling before the Arizona Supreme Court. The disciplinary panel, headed by Judge William O'Neill, concluded that the former prosecutors for Greater Phoenix pushed for unwarranted criminal charges and indictments, filed a federal racketeering lawsuit, and initiated investigations against Arpaio's political foes between 2006 and 2010. Thomas defended his actions, declaring that he went after corrupt officials that the political and legal establishment covered up, which he says provoked retaliation in the form of targeting his law license. According to the Arizona Republic, the misconduct will cost Maricopa County taxpayers nearly $2 million in legal settlements with local officials targeted by Thomas and Arpaio. Joe Arpaio also faces a civil rights probe by the U.S. Justice Department, but the sheriff has thus far refused to cooperate. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
On April 16th, the day before tax returns were due for most Americans, the U.S. Senate took up debate on the so-called Buffett Rule, legislation named for billionaire Warren Buffett, who declared that wealthy people like him should be paying a greater percentage of taxes on their income than, for example, his secretary. A bill championed by President Obama would have set a minimum 30% tax rate for anyone earning at least $1 million a year. But Senate Republicans succeeded in blocking debate on the bill by a 51-45 vote, denying Democrats the 60 votes needed to break a GOP filibuster. Congressional Republicans and the party's presidential candidates have long argued that increasing taxes on the nation's wealthiest individuals and corporations would hinder the creation of new jobs. The position, often referred to as the trickle-down philosophy, was adopted by President Ronald Reagan when he was elected in 1980. Over the past three decades, taxes on the wealthiest Americans have decreased to their lowest level since the Great Depression. At the same time, income inequality has risen to the highest point since 1928. After the emergence of the Occupy Wall Street protest movement last September, the issue of growing income inequality has become a focus of discussion across the U.S., both at the dinner table and in political debate in this presidential election year. A recent CNN poll found that 72% of Americans surveyed support the Buffett Rule, including 53% of Republicans. Your reporter spoke with Lee Ferris, senior organizer on a state and federal tax policy with United for a Fair Economy, a group that has long drawn attention to America's rising disparity in wealth. Ferris discusses the Buffett Rule and the other reforms her group advocates to make the nation's tax system fairer for working families.
It's a 30-year trend of downward or lessening tax rates for wealthy people, and that's why you get situations like what Warren Buffett was complaining about, where he's saying that his tax rate is lower than his secretary's tax rate, and there are numbers of millionaires and billionaires that are in that situation, and one of the reasons they're in that situation is that the tax code is shifted towards wealth. So folks that already have money get lower tax rates than people who don't have money yet. It seems really crazy. But for example, investment income such as capital gains when you sell stock or dividends that get paid annually on stock, that gets taxed at a maximum of 15% a year, whereas income from work for people that earn several hundred thousand dollars, that gets taxed at 35% a year. And where's the sense in that? Because most of the people that have the capital gains and dividend income are the wealthiest 1%, people that are having more than $1 million a year in income. So that's one of the problems. Another of the problems is that the Bush tax cuts cut tax rates for everybody, but they cut them more for very wealthy people that are earning hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars a year. So under President Clinton, the highest rate for that regular kind of work income used to be 39.6%, and now because of President Bush, it's 35%. And then another tax that only affects the very wealthy that has been reduced a lot is the estate tax, and that's the tax that multimillionaires, heirs pay when somebody passes on and their estate passes on. And that, under President Clinton, you could pass $1 million tax-free, which is quite a lot of money. But now, because of George Bush and further cuts that the Republicans in Congress extracted from President Obama, now you can pass on first $3.5 million tax-free. And under this new arrangement that's temporary, $5 million per spouse tax-free, which means $10 million tax-free for a couple, which is just a crazy amount of money for someone to be able to inherit tax-free. You know, if you won that in the lottery, for sure you'd be paying quite a lot of taxes on it, but not under our current tax system. And those are just three examples of the way the tax system is rigged for the wealthiest and richest 1%, and that's why we do need tax solutions for the 99%.
For decades, Republicans and conservatives and big corporations and the wealthy elite in the country have talked about the trickle-down philosophy that says raising taxes on the wealthiest individuals and corporations will reduce investment in new enterprises and limit or hurt the creation of new jobs. And of course, the idea that somehow higher taxes would hurt the creation of jobs is a sensitive issue in an economy that has been, you know, ripped apart by so much unemployment. But how do you respond to the idea that taxing wealthy individuals and corporations at a higher rate at this point will somehow hurt job creation?
Well, basically, I think it's a lot of malarkey. The reason why businesses are not creating jobs is they don't have customers with money to buy their goods. It's pretty straightforward. We, United for a Fair Economy, just put out a book that talks in part about this, the self-made myth, and it's about the myth of the self-made successful business person. And in that book, we show that, in fact, any business person is going to be getting somewhere with the help of investments that everybody has made together through the government, whether it's the internet, roads, bridges, whether it's an educated populace. And the business people that we profile in that book say in so many words that their tax rate has never affected any investment decision that they've made. They are only looking at whether they're going to be able to make a profit, and that the main thing that determines whether they can make a profit is whether they can get customers. Now, with so many unemployed people and people scared that they're going to lose their job, then people are less likely to buy things, whether it's computer or whether it's a service. People are still worried, and they still don't have enough cash to buy things.
Tell our listeners a bit about your organization, United for a Fair Economy's Tax Solutions for the 99%. It's a program that would rebalance our tax system to be fairer to working families and make sure that the wealthiest people in the country actually pay for some of the services that they use as individuals with lots of bucks.
The specifics are to end the Bush tax cuts altogether, just let them expire at the end of this year, to return to the level of the estate tax that we would have had under President Clinton, and to return to the level of the capital gains tax that we had under President Reagan. And that would mean that capital gains and dividends are taxed at the same rate as income, as I was describing earlier in the show. So people can check that out on faireconomy.org.
That was Lee Ferris, senior organizer on estate and federal tax policy with the group United for a Fair Economy. Find links to more analysis of the U.S. tax system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. April 17, 2012, marks exactly 40 years that two inmates in the Louisiana State Penitentiary, known as Angola Prison, have been held in solitary confinement for the murder of a prison guard, Brent Miller. Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox were serving sentences for separate armed robbery convictions when they formed a prison chapter of the Black Panther Party to fight for better prison conditions, including ending segregation and systematic rape. They organized strikes and sit-ins to press their cause. When Robert Hillary King, formerly Robert King Wilkerson, entered the prison shortly after the murder of the guard, he was linked to the crime through his association with the Black Panthers and investigated, but never charged. Supporters refer to the men as the Angola Three. King spent 29 of his 31 years in prison in solitary confinement before a 1973 conviction was overturned and he pled guilty to a lesser charge. He was released in 2001. Solitary confinement means spending 23 hours a day in a 6-foot by 9-foot cell and allowed outside only 3 times a week to walk around a concrete yard, weather permitting. There have been short periods in the past 4 decades when Woodfox, now 65, and Wallace, 70, were removed from solitary, but they are currently back in isolation. Both men have serious health issues. On April 17th, Amnesty International USA presented 65,000 petition signatures to Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal seeking an end to their solitary confinement, claiming such treatment amounted to torture. The day before petitions were to be delivered to Governor Jindal, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Everett Thompson, the Southeast Regional Director of Amnesty International USA, and to former inmate Robert King. Everett explains how prison officials justify continuing to hold Woodfox and Wallace under such conditions.
So they continue to say that they are in solitary confinement due to their original reason for lockdown. And their original reason for lockdown, again, is the murder of Brent Miller. Even though in 1996, the Louisiana prison policy was changed to remove original reason for lockdown as a way to account for someone to be still in solitary confinement. In their case, it continues to be the reason why they are on lockdown. So each time that their case is reviewed by the prison review board, it comes back that, you know, the reason why they cannot leave solitary confinement is due to the nature of the original reason for lockdown. So clearly, you know, there has to be some other political reasons that's not coming to the forefront.
Woodfox and Wallace have proclaimed their innocence in the murder of the prison guard, Brent Miller. What are they hoping for with this additional attention and all these petitions? Just to get out of solitary? I know Amnesty and other human rights organizations defined prolonged solitary confinement as torture. Or do they want a new trial or for the governor to commute their sentences or what?
Amnesty International, our stance is looking at solitary confinement and saying that we want to make sure that Albert and Herman are released from solitary confinement. We've publicly stated that we have concerns about the legal process around Angola 3, around their cases, in the sense that there's no physical evidence. The potential DNA evidence has been lost. The convictions were based on questionable inmate testimony. We will continue to monitor the case and Albert and Herman's condition, but our goal is to shine a light on the use of solitary confinement and stating that these men should be treated with dignity and that they should be removed from solitary confinement.
Everett Thompson, do you have any clue as to what Governor Bobby Jindal will do in this case? I know at least a few Louisiana politicians have called their conditions of confinement cruel and unusual punishment.
No indication at all. We've contacted Governor Jindal's office many times over the past couple of weeks, requesting a meeting to discuss the case of Angola 3, to inquire about the use of solitary confinement within this case, and there's been no response. Governor Jindal has the opportunity to stand on the right side of justice and order removal of Albert and Herman from isolation. So we really hope that he would take heed and make some moves.
That was Everett Thompson of Amnesty International USA. Robert King, the third of the Angola Three, after describing the abysmal prison conditions he endured for three decades, explains what kept him going while in solitary confinement.
I had become politicized by this time, and I had changed my whole concept. I just, you know, saw myself as being a target. I had saw myself as, you know, being a political prisoner that I was targeted because of whom I was, and I had begun to see some things that, you know, other people were saying to be correct. For instance, like, you know, this was during a period, you know, when the protests against Vietnam, when it was shooting kids down at Kent State and, you know, Jackson State. I'm talking about the, you know, the U.S. National Guard was doing this. Kids, you know, protesting war. And then the Black Panther Party was on the set. You know, Martin Luther King had just recently been killed. Malcolm X was killed 5 years earlier. So, you know, things were happening. And so even though I was, you know, not, you know, at the time, I could not explain and articulate some of the stuff that was going on, I felt it. And I think when the Black Panther Party came on the set, I embraced the ideology because I think it was one that was really strong. And I think it was part of the thing that helped me to survive. And so having this new ideology, I think it really gave me the flotation that I needed to survive. But I must say this to you, when people ask me how you survive, you know, 29 years in solitary confinement, I don't know if that's really possible. It's kind of hard to get dipped in waste and not come up stinking. You know, you might not, it may not be smelly, it may not be apparent, but the effects are there. And I don't want to minimize the impact of solitary confinement. It's cruel, you know, it's inhuman. The soul cries. And, I mean, it's kind of hard to, how can you define when the soul cries? It's not alliterative. So it was pretty rough, pretty hard.
That was Robert King, the only member of the Angola 3 who has been released from prison. Read more about the case and extended solitary confinement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Summit of the Americas meeting in Cartagena, Colombia, April 14th and 15th, the first such gathering since 2009, concluded without an official declaration of shared principles from the more than 30 heads of state in attendance. Although a list of important issues were discussed, the eruption of a scandal alleging that members of the U.S. Secret Service were engaged in improper conduct with prostitutes overshadowed much of the news coverage of the summit. Washington's decades-long insistence on excluding Cuba's communist government from participation in hemispheric summits was one of several issues that remained unresolved. Many of the region's leftist leaders were joined by conservative Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, who called for Cuba's inclusion in future gatherings. President Obama, who is campaigning for re-election, maintained the 50-year-old policy of barring Cuba from hemispheric meetings with an eye on not angering Florida's politically powerful Cuban-American voters. Mr. Obama and the Colombian president negotiated a separate agreement on labor rights, which will allow a controversial bilateral free trade treaty between the two nations to go into effect on May 15th. The labor rights certification angered AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, who stated that 90% of the nearly 3,000 murders of Colombian trade unionists since 1986 were unsolved and unpunished. Your reporter spoke with Alex Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about some of the issues raised at the Summit of the Americas, including a reassessment of the failed U.S. war on drugs.
This summit was originally designed to promote a U.S. free trade agenda. That was certainly what Bill Clinton had in mind in 1994. And at the first summit, all the leaders present decided that they all agreed that there needed to be a free trade area of the Americas. Now, this changed over time, and by the 2000s, and specifically 2005, when the summit was held in Argentina, you had a number of countries who were opposed to the U.S. free trade agenda. That is an agenda basically set by the U.S. government with U.S. corporate interests behind it in terms of the terms that were set with the other countries in the region. And ultimately, the free trade area of the Americas was no longer on the agenda after that 2005 summit. And what we're seeing in this summit is that, differently from previous summits, the U.S. is really not hasn't been in control of the agenda. There's been a lot of discussion about the exclusion of Cuba. That's not something that the U.S. is particularly interested in discussing. There's been also a great deal of discussion about U.S. drug policy, and a few leaders of the region, particularly in Central America, are talking about the need for decriminalization as a response to dealing with the drug wars. Now, it's not just Mexico, which I think we hear the most about in the media, but also much of Central America that's been terribly afflicted by the so-called war on drugs. And there's a homicide rate without precedent, particularly in Honduras, where a coup occurred in 2009. There's really the highest homicide rate in the world at present. And there's really the beginning of a rebellion against the policies that have been promoted by the U.S., policies of militarization, that is, using the military as much as possible to clamp down on organized crime. So that's something that's being rejected more and more, and there are a few countries, interestingly, with governments that are normally quite aligned with the U.S., like in Guatemala, where we're seeing the governments actually calling for a discussion on the possible decriminalization of drugs as a response to dealing with the drug war.
Alex, when it comes to the issue of exclusion of Cuba from these summit meetings, it looks like a growing number of heads of state around the hemisphere, including allies like the nation of Colombia, are backing the inclusion of Cuba in future meetings. The refrain that was heard a lot during this summit meeting was that this is an old relic of the Cold War and should be scrapped. Do you think there's going to be any movement on this?
Well, yeah, and what's interesting is that the individual who said this is a relic, or rather an anchor of the Cold War that the U.S. is stuck in, is President Santos of Colombia himself. And this is arguably the U.S.'s biggest ally in the region. There was no way that the U.S. was going to show any flexibility at this summit on the issue of Cuba. At the previous summit 3 years ago, they didn't. Of course, they'd eased travel restrictions and restrictions on remittances at the time. This time around, they have nothing to offer Cuba. And of course, we are in election mode just now. And President Obama is very much focused on the votes in Florida, and winning Florida is, of course, a key swing state of the upcoming elections.
There was a People's Summit meeting that occurred alongside the Summit of the Americas in Cartagena. Who was attending that, and what was the agenda like there in contrast to what the heads of state were discussing behind closed doors and their big hotel?
This is something that's been happening at Latin American summits for quite some time now. When there's a summit of heads of state, there's often a counter summit that's organized. And occasionally these counter summits actually include, to some extent, government officials from some of the left-leaning governments of the region. But those that organize them are from various social movements, campesinos, small farmer movements, indigenous movements, environmental movements, and also, you know, various labor organizations throughout the hemisphere. And these include not just Latin American organizations, but also organizations from the U.S. and Canada that come down as well. They work together on, they tend to hold workshops and so on. They hold rallies. They try to make themselves heard to the governments in the summit. And they always come up with some sort of a final declaration, so a series of issues that they agree on. And what I thought was interesting this time around, perhaps more than ever when we look at previous counter-summits of this kind, is that there's quite a bit of agreement between these social movements and the Latin Americans on the issue of Cuba, on the issue of the Falkland Islands, on drug issues, and so on.
That was Alex Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. For more perspectives on issues raised at the Summit of the Americas, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.